Today on Maine Calling, your summertime garden. Hooey, it's hot out there. Summer has arrived with an exclamation point. What does that mean for your garden? Might your lettuce bolt? Do you need to baby that tree you planted this spring? Cut back your herbs? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we check in with gardening experts for answers to your mid-season gardening questions. Today's show is a little different in that we will be joined by a whole group of UMaine Cooperative Extension gardening experts because they are all in the same place today at a retreat. So we'll ask them some of our toughest garden questions. What is your intractable garden problem? Ask it. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Support for Maine Calling comes from Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure throughout Maine. Now open in Bangor, Waterville, and Augusta. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. If you have gardening questions, we have answers. We have a whole team of horticulture experts joining us today. That's because the UMaine Cooperative Extension Horticulture Team is taking a moment from their summer retreat. They're all together in one place to take your questions. We are talking with today Tori Jackson, who is Program Leader for Agriculture and Natural Resources, Lynn Holland, who's a Horticulture Professional and Master Garden Coordinator. She leads the Pollinator Friendly Garden Program and Maine Harvest for Hunger. Kate Garland is a Horticulture Professional and Master Gardener Volunteer Coordinator. She specializes in school gardens and is a botanist by training. And Majot Sidhu is an ornamental horticulture specialist with UMaine Cooperative Extension. And Jonathan Foster is statewide horticulturalist at large. And he is the person behind the Extension's Ask the Expert service. We invite you to pose your question to this amazing team. See if you can stump them. Send in your questions by email, talk@mainepublic.org. Post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Welcome to all of you. And this is quite unusual for us on Maine Calling. So hopefully it's not too chaotic and you all are all well behaved. Lynn, I'm going to start with you and just ask you, when a bunch of gardening experts get together at a retreat, people from all over the state, what's the hot topic? What's the hot topic this year?
Well, today we're celebrating our Master Gardener volunteer work, and we're planning what kind of new educational material we're going to be working on in the coming year. So that's our focus today, and also staying cool.
Staying cool. But what about just sort of over lunch and over dinner? What are you all talking about?
Oh, gosh, what are we talking about? Just the usual sort of stuff, projects, what cool projects we're doing, what new things we're seeing. We've been talking about pretty much. Oh, go ahead, Kate.
Oh, well, I was just going to say we're actually at the Curtis Memorial Library in Brunswick, and it is stunning. So I just want to give a shout out to the Master Gardener volunteers and the staff here who have done a great job. And it's just a wonderful space to really have that conversation about the work and important work that Master Gardeners are doing throughout the state.
Okay, Tori, as Lynn mentioned, it's very hot out there right now. So I'm going to be selfish and start this program with a very personal question. This morning, I got up early looking at the forecast and gave my vegetable garden a really good soaking. But that's all I did. And I have some really beautiful lettuce. I do not want it to bolt. I don't want to harvest it right now because I have plenty in the refrigerator. What do I do? Do I have to go out there with stakes and an old sheet and give it some shade?
Well, ideally shade cloth would be a nice addition. Kudos for getting it watered before it got really hot today. Watering early in the morning and in the evening is always best. Lettuce is a tough one. You know, it wants to bolt in this kind of weather. So I would say enjoy as much lettuce as you can over the holiday, maybe BLTs for the fourth, and get ready for succession planting.
Get ready for succession planting. Okay, what does that mean? What does succession planting mean?
Great question. Succession planting is when you harvest a crop and then immediately follow it with another crop. Sometimes it's the same thing. So often we'll follow an early crop like radishes with greens or something that will last all summer.
All right, so if I do have to harvest a whole bunch of lettuce this week or today, what ought to go to next? Can I put more lettuce seedlings in?
You
Or
absolutely can.
seeds? Or seeds?
Seeding direct for lettuce can be tricky, very small seeds, but it can be done if you have a nice smooth seed bed. If you want to start those inside and move them out after this heat has left us in a few weeks or so, that could work well.
Okay. All righty. I want to turn to you, Jonathan, because you've been the ask the expert guy for a couple years, and I have a sense from hosting Maine Calling what kind of questions come in, but I want to ask you, are there two or three big questions that you get over and over again from folks who are looking for some help, people who are desperate for help?
Yeah, there certainly are. One of the interesting things about running the Ask an Expert portal is that we get such a broad diversity of questions coming in. So it's a huge volume and it covers a lot of topics. A very common one this year are people who are struggling, I think, with drought stress, who do not realize that we have been under drought conditions for the last couple of years. They want to know why their perennials aren't doing that great. They look a little bedraggled, they look a little brown. And so we visit with them about doing a little supplemental watering, making sure that your plants have got what they need to weather this hot weather, so to speak. Perennial favorites, Japanese knotweed, Asiatic bittersweet. How do I get these out of my yard? Those are usually somewhat depressing conversations to have with gardeners around the state, but they do still come up and we try and help them out with that. And then we get a lot of this time of year, especially fungal questions, fungal foliar issues. So I've got spots on my leaves, I've got discoloration on my leaves. You know, drought-stressed plants from the last couple of years going through a very wet spring. That's fantastic conditions for fungal proliferation. So we see a lot of that this time of year too.
Okay, so the fact that we had a drought, we've been in drought on and off for the last couple of years, and then we had a wet spring, that's what's happening with people's gardens if they're seeing something that they haven't seen before.
It's an excellent setup for a fungal proliferation. The plant's already stressed, so its natural defenses are lowered, and then we get a lot of hot, wet air sticking around those plants.
So what does one do about a fungal proliferation?
Well, I should preface this first by saying I'm not a pathologist, but I do a lot of pathology in the job. Most fungal foliar issues tend to be cosmetic in nature. They can be tolerated. So we recommend a few standard fungal foliar protocols for people. Prune out the worst looking parts of the plant, remove any dead plant material that's fallen to the ground underneath it. Any of that material spores can survive on and reinfect. When you're watering plants, we stress you water the soil, you don't water the plant. So get the irrigation down into the soil, no overhead sprinkling. And then just generally thinning out any bushy overgrowth. You're really trying to promote warm, dry airflow through the canopy of whatever the plant is. And that helps the plant sort of mitigate those symptoms.
All right. Well, I'm going to turn to you, Manjot, and ask, maybe this spring people were ambitious and they went out and bought a new shrub or two, or maybe a new tree. With this heat coming on, how should we be babying those newer additions to our garden, especially if it's something we maybe splurged on and spent a little more money than we usually do?
Yeah, I think especially with the heat that's going on, I guess for the baby plants, mulching would be a really good thing to do so that you can preserve moisture for them. And apart from that, so just take care of their nutrition, and regular watering schedule.
And just doing the regular management and taking care of if they are being hit by any, you know, any insects or diseases, because they won't have enough, you know, leaves on them. So they're not attacked by, you know, the common insect pests and all the leaves being eaten out. So just be cautious about all those things and keep them, you know, well watered, well, and the nutrient management should be good. And yeah, just keep them healthy.
Mm-hmm. And would you say that that is often an issue, especially for newer gardeners, that people don't water enough when the plants are young, that they think they're watering, but you young plants really need a lot of water?
Yeah, depends upon if the plants are in containers or they're directly in the soil. So if they are in containers, like if you have perennials in the containers, then you have to, you know, wash them out when they're really dry, when the soil really dries out before you actually water them, because you don't want them waterlogged and, you know, cut off the oxygen to their roots. And that would be, you know, that would again, you know, kill the plants. So when they are outside, I guess mulching is a really good thing to do in the garden. And yeah,
and what
so
do you like to bulk?
Especially, sorry.
Yeah, what's your mulch of choice?
You could do some wood chips, or like in containers, you could do rice hull. Yeah, wood chips is a good one.
Okay, I'm going to turn to you,
pine
Kate.
Bark or-
Yeah, Kate, I know that you, among many duties, are up there at the demonstration garden at Rogers Farm. I'm wondering what you're seeing there right now. How is this year different or similar to years past?
Oh, we're having a really great year. We are, our flow at the demonstration garden is different in a lot of cases than the traditional landscape, in that we plant a little bit later. The majority of the garden, a lot of the garden is perennials, so those obviously come up on their own, but a lot of our annuals just got popped in last week, and a lot of our direct seeded crops, like we just put in some sunflowers. And that's intentional, because we host a lot of school field trips and have a lot of visitors, and we don't want a lot of those little annuals to get trampled or pulled by mistake. And but that's, I think, tells a story in itself, that a lot of gardeners, they feel very rushed at the beginning of the season. And we get a lot of questions right now of, we didn't get around to planting X, Y, and Z. Is it too late to? And it certainly is not too late to plant. And so many vegetable crops, there's some great, we have a great planting chart that I always point people to as far as what kind of window of time we can still plant our vegetables. But it's still time to, you can still put in maybe a few sunflower seeds if it's a short season sunflower. Just looking at the days to harvest on the seed packet can help you guide you and let you know whether it's still a possibility to enjoy that.
Well, let me ask you this. You said it's not too late to plant. If someone's hearing this, though, would you recommend they wait until these next couple days have passed, this super hot weather?
Yes and no. Like if you're direct seeding things and getting them in, I think you'd be absolutely fine. And you don't want to wait too long for a lot of, especially some of our ornamental seedlings. But yes, if you can avoid transplanting in this stressful time, then that would be ideal. I will be very honest, though. I was out there on Tuesday night popping things in, because that's when I had the time to do it. So we do have to look at things practically and look at and you know, do things when we absolutely have the time to, but there are more ideal times to do it. Ideally, transplanting when it's overcast and rainy is the best. Well, and I try to do that whenever possible, but
that's a really good point, because a lot of people have maybe Friday as a holiday, so they have a day off and they can do some work in the garden, but boy, it's going to be hot on Friday.
Yeah. I mean, trying to target things when it's a little bit less stressful for the plant. So sometimes in the evening, giving it a little bit of time in, you know, over that dark period to just kind of get settled in and watered in really well, might be that sweet spot, and also better for you as a gardener to not do it in the heat of the day.
Yeah, Jonathan, I want to circle back to you. When I was asking you about the questions that you get for Ask the Expert, and you said through the portal. What is the portal? How does it work? How does someone ask the expert if they aren't able to get through today?
Sure. So we have a web page that easily findable. If you Google UMaine Ask an Expert, it pops right up. Our county offices also have QR codes that clients who walk in can scan and go straight to the web page. And it's basically tell us what's going on. Show us pictures if you've got them. Tell us where you are. Is this a pest or a pathogen question? Is this a vegetable question? Is this an ornamental question? Is this soil and water? And then it comes through into a queue that I manage. One of the nice things about it is that I have cross privileges with our UMaine Plant Disease Diagnostic Lab, as well as our extension entomology personnel. So whenever I get a client question in, I can very easily get input from our plant pathology people. Does this look disease oriented? From our entomologist folks, is this insect related? And then I can direct it to a different expert if it fits somebody else's expertise better. Shorthand, I refer to it as the portal.
Okay, well, I'm gonna try to squeeze in a question before we go to the break. We'll go to Christina calling from Auburn. Hi, go ahead.
Hello, thanks for taking my call. Thank you for taking my call. Quick question. I have a peach tree, well, and a cherry tree. I planted the peach tree 2.5 years ago or so. It's doing fabulous. It's about, I'd say, 8 wide by 10 or 12 tall. And in a good sense, we're having solar installed, ground-based solar. Unfortunately, it's where the peach tree is. So I wanted to know, I don't have a choice about waiting. In the next 2 or 3 weeks, I need to move it. Shall I prune it a little first? Just take as much root ball as I can? Or is it just a sacrifice? Shall I? Those are my questions.
What All right. I'll turn to you, Tori. Christina needs to try to save this peach tree. What's your advice?
Well, I appreciate that you recognize this is not an ideal time because there are no guarantees here. I would not prune it. I don't think you want to add any additional stress. But do take as much of the root ball as you possibly can. Go much wider than you think you need to. And take as much of that root as you can. If it needs to be out of the ground for much time before it's replanted, make sure it is in the shade, make sure it's getting some water, and take a lot of care when you're replanting it, and you know, as if it were a brand new tree. You know, maybe adding some compost to the new hole that you're moving into, and again, watering it as if it were new. So basically every day during the summer.
Christina, how large is the tree?
I said it was about 8 wide by 10 to 12 high, and I'm wondering if I should add root growth stimulator after I will transplant it quickly in the early morning.
And you have a team or some nice heavy equipment or
we're going to get more than just my husband and I. We're going to ask people for help because it's too much for two people, we think.
Jonathan.
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up on what Tori was saying and also what Jen is pointing out, which is that this is a pretty big tree. That's going to be a pretty major operation trying to move a tree that size and a root ball that size. Before you get too terribly deep into that project, I would keep in mind our fruit tree specialist, Dr. Renee Moran, tells us that the average lifespan for a peach tree in Maine is really only about 7 to 10 years of getting productivity out of it. So consider whether or not you really want to go through all of the hard work of moving this tree and keep in mind the bigger picture.
There you go, Christina. Boy, a lot more calls coming in. We are going to go to a quick break. What are your questions for this team, this great resource today, team of gardening experts from the UMaine Cooperative Extension? Our phone number 1-800-399-3566, or you can send us a brief email at talk@mainecalling.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. What challenges are you facing in your garden? Pests, weeds, invasives? Our Cooperative Extension horticulture experts will try to answer as many questions as possible today. Joining me, Lynn Holland, Kate Garland, Jonathan Foster, Tori Jackson, and Manjo Sidhue, all with the UMaine Cooperative Extension. They all have specialized expertises, if you will. And we invite you to join the conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Send us a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org, or comment on Facebook or Instagram. Before we go back to questions, I do want to say something positive about this year, and perhaps this is for you, Kate. It has been quite a beautiful season for roses, hasn't it?
It has. I feel like I've spotted so many wonderful displays, and I'm not sure the magic behind it. It may be that the winter was a little kinder to certain varieties, but yes, they're right in full bloom.
Okay. On that note, we'll go back to the problems. We'll go to Ian calling from Morrill. Hi, Ian, go ahead.
Hey, thank you. My question is about Virginia creeper. I assume the answer is maybe more like Japanese knotweed. What do you do with it? Like, probably not much. We struggle with beating it back every year and ripping it off trees. And when you try to rip it through the ground, it breaks off, and all it needs is a small piece to propagate again. What are the recommendations for keeping Virginia creeper at bay?
Ian, I think you would love to have seen the faces that our guests were making when you use the words Virginia creeper. Okay, guys, who's going to take this? Okay, Manjo?
So this is a perennial weed. For perennial weeds, you try to remove them manually if you don't have, a lot of them. Or you can cut them from the, really from the base. And when it sprouts up, you have to keep snapping it again and again, because that is a perennial problem. It requires a multi-year approach. And make sure you don't, let them, if you are pulling it out altogether, just don't leave it there. Just don't leave the fragments, because it's gonna come back. Other than that, you could go for, covering the soil with the landscape fabric, so that you just kill that or bake that with the heat underside. And I don't know if you want to go really for chemicals, but if that's the case, then you could go for systemic herbicides at the end of the season. So that is the time when they move their resources to the, underground parts. And that is when you want to kill all the underground, resources that they have in there. So that is the last spot. But before that, you could go for just, manual removal. And I think Kate has something to add on that.
Kate? Yeah, that was great, Manja. A couple things to add to it is that it does have some redeeming qualities. It is a native plant and host to a wide number of Lepidopteran species, so moth and butterflies. It does have some redeeming qualities. I understand that it's not wanted in this particular space. So just to add, another technique is, in addition to cutting it at the soil line, doing like what's called a window cut, meaning cutting it at the soil line and then cutting it up maybe about 2 feet up off the ground too, to just make sure, especially if you've got a really dense vine, sometimes it's hard to see that you've made all the cuts that you have if all the top growth is dangling down. And so if you can do two sets of cuts to try to make sure that you're getting all of it, and also avoid pulling it down from the trees that they're entwined in, because that can cause damage to the trees that they're entwined in. And it'll die off and it'll be fine if you just leave it right in the canopy. And sometimes you can pull it down after the fact, after it started to decay.
Oh, interesting. So trim it and just leave it if it's growing up a tree. Okay. Yep. Ian, I hope that's all helpful. Thank you for calling in with that question. Let's see here. We will go to Thankful in Bath. Hi, Thankful. Go ahead.
Hi. Well, you asked at the beginning, Jennifer, what is our most intractable problem? And ours is groundhogs. We had one quite fat one for about 3 years, and we could tolerate that. But now there are two little ones, and they are chewing everything in sight.
Oh, so, dear. Oh, Thankful. I have a friend who lost an entire vegetable garden in one night to groundhogs. Yeah. So they are really, it's amazing how much they can eat, those little guys. Who wants to take this one? No one wants to take it. Kate, I'm going to go to you.
I'll give it a shot just because I literally said to my colleagues that I woke up this morning and I said to myself, someone's going to ask a groundhog question. And so, I am by no means a wildlife expert, but I will say that we do get this question a lot, and it really does depend on the situation. I will say, and I'm hoping my colleagues will chime in too, that physical barriers are one of the number one methods to addressing woodchucks in a fairly practical way. And it depends on what you're trying to keep it away from. But for a lot of our vegetable crops, many of them don't require pollination and can be covered with a lightweight spun-bound cloth. That's what we do a lot in our demonstration garden and our lower garden that has a woodchuck condo association just below it. So we have a lot of woodchucks below there. So we just cover them with metal hoops, 9-gauge wire hoops, and then put a very lightweight cover over like our lettuce crops or any of our brassicas that don't require pollination. And sometimes even cucumbers that are parthenocarpic, meaning that they don't require pollination to develop fruit. Filling in holes can sometimes be enough of a deterrent if you're really persistent about it and trying to alter their habitat so it's less welcoming. You'll want to be careful around doing that. I think we're past their stage where their babies are being born. So you want to be humane about how you handle things as well. One thing that I will not recommend necessarily in most cases is trapping and relocating, because that is widely considered to be the least humane option. You would think it would be humane because you're not killing it, but you are actually in a lot of cases giving it a much slower death and in that process, because it's putting it in a new habitat where it doesn't have the resources, the known resources, and including habitat and housing and food. And it also is competing with other potential woodchuck populations. So it seems not intuitive to do it that way, but a lot of times people choose to dispatch it right at their site. So I know that's a hard thing for a lot of folks to consider, but starting in with that physical barrier and altering their housing is the two first starts.
Lynn.
If you're a total softy, you can also plant their own little garden. They're creatures of habit, and especially with the little new ones, if the mama teaches them to go to that garden and you've done those protective features on your garden, they may never find your garden, the little ones especially. They truly are creatures of habit.
Tori.
And I would say, get a nice outdoor camera and turn it into a YouTube special. I mean, people love to watch wild animals. So if you can maybe supplement your gardening income and buy some new transplants if you need them, you can do that with a nice YouTube channel from your woodchuck garden.
And just to be clear, if someone's talking about woodchucks or groundhogs, they're talking about the same thing, right?
Yes.
Yes. They're awfully cute and they're awfully ravenous. So thank you. Thank you. Thankful for the question. Let's see. We have tons of questions coming in. We'll start with this email from Holly. I have a number of swamp milkweed plants that attract beautiful monarch butterflies every year. Unfortunately, they also attract aphids that grow along the stems and up into the flower beds. What is the best way to get rid of the aphids? I don't want to use any heavy duty chemicals. So what I've always heard, Jonathan, is just spray them off with the hose. Is that what you do?
Yep, that's exactly right. Aphids, once they're knocked off of the plant, do not tend to climb back up on the plant. And a good jet of water from the hose will take care of 90% of your problem there. It will also, as an ancillary benefit, it'll clean off any honeydew that the aphids have already left on the surface of the plant, which is something that can attract ants, wasps, other creatures that are trying to get in there and get that delicious, delicious honeydew. It can be a little tricky to give that advice this kind of year if people are struggling with those fungal foliar issues that we were talking about earlier. You know, one of the big points we say is don't overhead spray, don't spray the leaves if you don't have to. That's somewhat at odds with the idea that you're hitting them to get rid of the aphids. So it's sort of a judgment call on the part of the gardener, whether or not that's the route you want to go.
All right, an email here from Greg. In the past few days, the potato beetles have invaded full force. What to do? Tori.
Well, we have an entire IPM program that deals with
what this. Does IPM mean?
Integrated pest management. So we have a program where we have scouts that go out to our commercial growers to look for things like the Colorado potato beetle and other pests, including aphids, to look at and see how many insects or, you know, what disease levels are we seeing and, you know, what would be the recommendation for that. In a garden, it's a little bit different because your tolerance level is different likely than a commercial operator. However, one of the great things about what is considered the biggest pest of potatoes is that they're really easy to hand pick. And so in a gardening situation, that is always my number one recommendation. If you have young people in your life who you would like to incentivize to be in the garden, this is a fantastic activity to have them go and pick the beetles off and plop them in a, you know, a yogurt container or a jar you have around. It's a good way to get some activity in the garden, an easy and non-chemical way to get the bugs out of your potatoes.
Oh boy, we have lots of hands. Let's start with Lynn.
So this is a real good succession planning idea. Also, if you can get a hold of some seed potato, go ahead and plant some seed potatoes now. When they get to the point where Colorado beetle would hit them, they're long gone. So you'll be picking those potatoes in late September, early October, and you can have them for Thanksgiving dinner.
Kate.
Yeah, and one other thing with those young folks that are out there looking at scouting your potato crop is to have them look underneath the foliage. The eggs are underneath the foliage, and you can kill a number of them just by swiping with your thumb underneath the foliage, and you can get 20 of them at a time versus picking one adult at a time. So it really helps getting ahead by looking under there. And also, a lot of small scale growers are growing their potatoes under that spun bound cloth too. And that can be a great physical barrier to keep the adults off and keep them from laying their eggs in the first place. And they don't require pollination to get those spuds that are growing underneath the ground.
We'll go to Becky calling from Westbrook. Hi, Becky, go ahead.
Yes, hi. We purchased probably about a 15-foot sunset maple a couple weeks ago, waiting to put it into our new property. And it's been hot. We've been watering it about 2 gallons every other night because it's in the big black container. We're ready to put it in the ground in about a couple days. We're hoping Sunday when the weather breaks. Any extra tips we should use? I did buy some tree and shrub soil. Anything else we should know? Give it, it's rather tall already. And there are some small branches down near the bottom where the leaves have yellowed, perhaps maybe from transport. Just asking that question.
Great question, Becky. So, you know, you're planting a tree that's been in a pot. I have a feeling our experts are going to recommend that you maybe trim some of the roots if they're root bound. Am I right? And is there anything one of you would like to add? Manjot.
Yeah, I can add a few things and maybe others can add then. So yes, you would want to open up the roots a little bit. And when you're going to plant it, maybe, so you have to dig a hole, which should be like one and a half to like 2 times larger than the root ball so that it gets enough space of loosened up soil. And that should be, that is both the width and the depth of the soil that you want to dig. And just make sure you have you must know what the status of your soil is. So is it acidic or what is the nutrient status of that? So that should be matching with what maple needs. So just taking care of the planting depth.
So you want a great big hole, 1.5 to 2 times as deep and as wide, and you want to have some nice fertile soil in that after you put the plant in. You want to maybe trim the roots at the bottom if they're root bound. The level, Kate, the level you plant the tree, don't you want the very top of the ground to be level with where the ground was, if you will, in the pot? You don't want it higher or lower, right?
Yeah, you want to have the plant present with the at the same level as the soil that it was in the pot, and at the same soil level that it's going to be planted in. So I usually dig the hole about the same depth there, and I use kind of a stick to kind of gauge that height so that as I'm centering that plant in the hole, I'm making sure that it matches with the height of the soil around it. And I will put a plug in for our bulletin, planting and early care of trees and shrubs. That's a really great resource. It's very comprehensive and has a nice diagram in case you're a visual person like me and want to see how that what we're all sharing.
Yeah, planting and you said it's planting and early care.
Yep, of trees and shrubs. And if you just put in like any gardening topic, if you just put in that topic and then the word humane. Not humane, but UMaine, as in University of Maine. A lot of times we have a bulletin on that topic, and this is definitely one that's very popular.
And Kate, I have a feeling, or somebody, one of you will want to use this as an opportunity to warn against mulch volcanoes. Go ahead, Jonathan.
If I have my hand up, I'll take that one too. I just wanted to throw in a quick follow-up on what Manjot had said about the importance of knowing your soil conditions. If you have a big expensive plant, like a new tree that you're putting in there, it's a really great time to get the soil tested where you're planning on putting it in there. Putting the right plant in the right spot is a fantastic way to make sure that that plant's going to do well over the course of its life. The UMaine Analytical Soil Lab can do testing for citizens of Maine. It'll give you measurements of your organic material, your pH, and your nutrient concentration so that you can put amendments in early. On the volcano mulching, what Jen is referring to is if you drive around often in municipal plantings, you'll see trees with a little cone of mulch at the base. Starting out at the drip line, and then it goes up to hit the trunk, makes it look like a volcano. And the reason we don't recommend that is that all of that moist mulch up against the tree bark can cause stem rot issues eventually. So it looks like you're helping the plant out, and a lot of people think that it looks nice aesthetically, but we really recommend if you're going to mulch those trees, it's a flat disc. Out to the drip line. You don't want it to come all the way up to the stem for the same reason. You want to leave a little bit of space between the mulch and the trunk. But other than that, nice and flat, no volcanoes.
All right. Well, Becky, good luck to you. We do need to take another quick break. Our phone number 1-800-399-3566. We are asking a number of gardening experts the tough gardening questions on Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we're doing something a little different. All the experts with the UMaine Cooperative Extension are with each other right now at a retreat, and they are all joining us, not all, but five of them are joining us today. We have Kate Garland, Jonathan Foster, Tori Jackson, Lynn Holland, and Manjot Sidhu. All have different specialties, but all know a great deal about gardening. What are your questions for them? Our phone number 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainpublic.org. We'll go to Devin calling from Brunswick. Hi, Devin. Go ahead.
Hi, Devin. Yes, I am calling from Brunswick, and I wanted to ask about my two rhododendron plants, which I put in the ground about 2 years ago, and they are growing vigorously. Each summer they have put out great new growth. However, they don't blossom for some reason. And I had heard that rhododendrons often won't bloom the first summer after you plant them or the summer you plant them. But now, as we're into our third summer, and they're just not blooming to speak of. One of them did put out about three wee tiny little blossoms earlier, which quickly fell off. So okay. what's the story?
All right. Who wants to take that? The rhododendron question. Nobody's raising their hand, by the way, Devin. Okay, here goes Kate. Kate and Manjo. Kate, you go first.
So one of my questions, we oftentimes ask a question in response to a question is, have you been pruning at all? Or do you think, is there a chance that Something in Mother Nature may be pruning your plant, like a deer nibbling on the flower buds. Is that a possibility?
No, I haven't been pruning, and nothing has been pruning for me. Nothing or no one. My backyard is fenced, and while there are deer in the area, I've never seen them in my yard. So I don't think anything is chewing on it. So.
Okay. Another possibility I would explore is soil testing to see if there might be some nutrient deficiencies, or in particular, a need to adjust the pH of your soil. And that can cause the nutrients might be there, but because the pH is off, it might make those nutrients not available to the plants themselves, or kind of not, it might bind the nutrients so that they're not available to the plants. So it might be a matter of adjusting the pH. And I'm guessing Manjot has some other ideas too.
Yeah, another thing, the hottest one is the drought stress that we had last year. So the rhododendrons, they put up their new buds in June and July. That is when we had the, you know, severe drought stress last year. So if you were not doing deep watering when we had drought stress last year, so that means the plant is putting more of its energy towards leaves and roots versus to the flowers. So that would be another reason.
All right, Devin, well, good luck to you. Let me ask you, Manjo or Kate, if Devin keeps her rhododendrons where they are, will they eventually bloom?
I would say if there is a reflection in the soil test that something needs to be adjusted, I would be hopeful that taking those steps and recommendations by the soil testing lab will actually result in that. And also wisely what Manjot said about making sure you're really mindful of the watering practices, that should help, hopefully.
Okay, well, good luck to you, Devin. Okay, guys, a big one. Here's an email from John. How to eradicate equisetum. Is that how you pronounce it, the Latin word? And I know that what this is, look, everybody's laughing. Everybody is laughing. This is horsetail. I know a little bit about horsetail. I know that it's prehistoric, and it is a astonishing survivor. And my impression is that it's impossible to eradicate, but tell me, you all, if I'm wrong, Jonathan.
No, you're not wrong. That was going to be my first answer. You can't get rid of it. It's incredibly depressing to say to our caller. There are some things that you can do primarily with changing the habitat for it. You can try to boost the competitiveness of other plants that you've got in the area. You can keep it mowed. You can try to dry things out a little bit. It does tend to like moisture settings. But it's something that's probably you're going to have to just get accustomed to managing. You know, they can grow tens and hundreds of meters away from the original plant, and there really are not any herbicides that are terribly effective on them. Hand pulling does not help. Their roots go really, really deep, and they can resprout from really deep. So it's you know, from one perspective, I like to take a page from my colleague Kate Garland's book, who's always very optimistic about plants. It's an amazing evolutionary story. It is an incredibly adaptable plant. It's very pretty. It does well in a lot of different settings. But boy, when it's in your field or your garden, it's not much fun.
So Kate is the positive one here. Kate, you want to add some positive positivity about horsetail? I read, and tell me if this is true, that it can be, a fragment can be 2 meters deep and grow.
Yeah.
So bringing in a backhoe to take out, you know, the top 3 feet of your soil and replacing it is not going to do anything for horsetail.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all about choosing your battles. And I, in grad school, I gardened for a couple, and they had this beautiful fern bed, and there was a horsetail all through it. And the wife loved the horsetail, and the husband hated it. And it was quite a conversation and a thing to navigate. But we did end up just leaving it in place because there were other projects that needed to be attended to, and that was not one we were going to win. So without a lot of time.
We'll go to Bill calling from Freeport. Hi, Bill. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've got an old apple tree out in my front yard that's too close to the driveway. And at some point in its life, it started growing at a 90-degree angle to its trunk. And whether it was a branch that grew, I don't know. It happened a long time ago. But it's all rotted out at the point where it makes the right angle bend. And so the cambium runs up one side of the tree until it gets to this junction where it's all rotted out and hollow. And then at the junction, the cambium is still alive around the bend and continues up, and the tree is prospering on the upper section, and it fruits every year, and the apples are delightful. But the tree makes this right angle bend out across the driveway. And what I would love to do is, and what I'm wondering if it's possible, to take any grafts off the upper part of the tree and graft them in down lower so that I can lose the section of the tree that's growing out over the driveway, but continue to grow new shoots into the tree closer to the ground.
Okay, an interesting question. Who wants to tackle Bill's question? Tori.
I'll start. This is a tough one. It's hard to say how much damage this tree is dealing with and how much longer it has in general. I do love grafting onto old apple trees. I think that can be a great way to keep it vigorous for longer. But that's a pretty big project for what sounds like an older tree. And you want to be mindful of how low you're going. You know, you don't want to get lower on the trunk than where you're describing this this rotten area. I don't know if those new branches would take very well there. Yeah, it's tough. We do have a great publication on renovating old apple trees, and there may be some good ideas in there too. I think pruning in general, an old tree can really do a lot for it. So we've got a publication and some information on our website. Kate, do you have other thoughts?
I just want to put a plug in to any in-person opportunities that you can related to grafting are going to be so valuable if you choose to take that route. It doesn't sound like you it might be that you have to do something sooner than later, but if you have time on your side and can experience a grafting workshop, that would be great. I will put a plug in for our MOFCA, Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association. They have a Maine apple camp at the end of August, and then they have, and that's, I think, a biennial event that they do, and then they have their annual Great Maine Apple Day, and they have a Scion Exchange. So they have some really great hands-on opportunities at their orchard as well for the home gardener.
All right, Bill, thanks for your question. From Susan, another fruit tree question. I have a dwarf cherry tree that's 4 or 5 years old and is about 5 feet tall. It does not have a main trunk down near the ground. It has split into two main trunks. My question, should I cut off one of those two main trunks or let it continue to grow that way?
Honestly, if the tree is thriving in that current mode, I wouldn't be in any hurry to make a change that drastic. In general, when we're talking about stone fruits, we actually want to maintain sort of an open vase shape for the canopy. So if the trunk is aiding you in that in some way, you know, maybe it's allowing more light and air through the canopy naturally. So unless it's a problem, unless it's splitting and, you know, kind of heading towards the ground, I wouldn't worry about that at all.
All right. So I we have only about a minute left, and I just want to ask, and maybe I'll turn to you, Lynn, or Kate, you can jump in as well. Just a broad question. We keep bringing up the word drought, and I think a lot of people may not realize the impact that the last couple of years has had on their plants. generally speaking, what kind of advice would you give to gardeners today in the next 30 seconds about how to keep everything as healthy as possible given the situation that we've been in the last couple of years?
Well, I always say I'm a Darwinian gardener, survival of the fittest. But if you've got important plants in your life, you definitely want to make sure they get that 1 inch of water per week. And that drought, we've started out the season with a deficit. So you can't miss a week.
Okay.
You can't miss a week. And you really have to realize that, like people, plants need water. And if you're thirsty today, you better believe your plants are thirsty today, too.
All right. Well, that's a great way to end the program. I know that many of you had questions we did not get to in the hour, but remember, we have an expert. There's the Ask the Expert portal. If you Google Ask an Expert and UMaine, it will pop right up. Thank you all for joining us today. Kate Garland, Jonathan Foster, Tori Jackson, Lynn Holland, and Manjot Sidhu, all with the UMaine Cooperative Extension, all at their summer retreat. Today's sound engineer is Jane Donahue. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to listen back to our earlier program about former Governor Ken Curtis. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.